Chapter 6. The Rise of North Korea. The Years of Rapid Development. Total Victory of the Partisans. Kim Il-sung's Consolidation of Power. Kim Il-sung's attempt to liberate the South had been a disaster. When the fighting stopped in July 1953, his country was in ruins. He had brought death and destruction upon his people on a vast scale and had nothing to show for it. Rather than reuniting the country, he had hardened the division within it and now faced a heavily armed Republic of Korea with a substantial U.S. military presence. Many leaders would not have survived such a setback. But Kim not only survived, he consolidated his power, eliminating all his rivals, and forged ahead with his plans to create a modern industrial socialist state. This might seem surprising, but Kim Il-sung proved to be a nimble survivor. First, he shifted blame for the failure to liberate the South on the domestic communists. Only 1 week after the signing of the armistice, he began to purge them. Pak Hon-yong and his mostly southern comrades were held responsible for the failure to reunite the country, since they had promised uprisings in the South that did not materialize. Kim conducted a Stalinist show trial of the 12 most prominent domestic communists, all originally from the South. It turned out that they were all secretly in league with the enemy and had deliberately sabotaged the liberation. Each confessed to being a South Korean or American agent. All were then executed. Only Pak Hon-yong was spared, but not for long. He was arrested and executed 2 years later, when it turned out that he, too, had been secretly plotting with the Americans. In fact, he had been covertly working for the Americans since the late 1930s, so it was not Kim's blunders, but a massive conspiracy by his rivals that had brought about defeat. Kim Il-sung didn't stop there. In 1955, he purged Pak Il-u, a prominent Yan'an faction member whose personal connections with Mao failed to save him. Then, in 1956, he faced a challenge from the Soviet and Yan'an factions. While away on a visit to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, drumming up aid for his development plans, some of his comrades began intriguing against him. Weeks earlier in February, Khrushchev had denounced Stalin's cult of personality, and Moscow was beginning to nudge the little Stalins from power. These were the leaders that they had promoted in their Eastern European satellites, each with a personality cult patterned on Stalin's. This emboldened Che Chang-yi of the Yan'an group and Pak Chang-o of the Soviet group to challenge their own little Stalin. But Kim, upon returning, had them removed from office. Only intervention by Beijing and Moscow saved them and their associates from arrest, or worse. The reprieve was temporary, however. In 1957, Kim began a massive purge that lasted 3 years. About 100,000 people were arrested, amounting to almost 2% of the adult population, and about 2,500 were executed. A few Soviet and Yan'an group members managed to flee to the safety of the USSR and the PRC, but most were not so lucky. By the end of the purge, almost all of the key positions and most of the mid-level positions in the party, the state bureaucracy, and the military were held by Kim's former guerrilla comrades or their clients. One Yan'an group member, Kim Chung-man, still held a high post. He had become one of Kim Il-sung's most ardent supporters early on, denouncing his fellow Yan'an group members and anyone else whose absolute loyalty to the great leader was questioned. In the end, however, being more Catholic than the Pope didn't save him either, and he disappeared a few years later. By the 1960s, only Kim Il-sung's comrades from the Manchurian Mountains, his relatives, and some of his comrades' relatives held any positions of authority. And what a group this was to lead the modernization of the country. Few had completed middle school, and some had no formal schooling at all. Few had any foreign experience. Some had never even been to a large city until they arrived in Pyongyang. Isolated, provincial, and not even having grown up in the country they were now governing, they may have been among the least educated ruling elite of any modern country. When Kim Il-sung died in 1994, the leadership roster was largely the same lineup as it had been in the late 1960s, minus those who had died of natural causes over the years. Thus, this small band of several hundred guerrilla veterans and their families retained their grip on power for half the century. As they died off, they were replaced by their sons, in-laws, and close protégés. It was a small, tight-knit, increasingly intermarried elite that held most of the key positions in the party, military, and bureaucracy under three generations of the Kim family. North Korea's great leap forward, recovery and rapid industrialization. While Kim and his partisans were eliminating all possible challengers, they were also busy rebuilding and remolding their society. North Korea literally rose from the ashes to become an industrial nation. By almost any measure, its economic development from 1953 to the 1970s was an impressive achievement. In a little more than two decades, it went from a mostly rural agricultural society to a mostly urban industrial one. It emerged as a modern society with levels of education and health care that were among the highest in Asia. North Korea recovered from the wartime destruction with remarkable speed. Within 3 years, factories were rebuilt and industrial production had recovered to about where it had been at the start of the war. It had more than a little help from its friends. The Soviet Union and its Eastern European allies, such as East Germany, provided generous support, and China put the large number of its troops still stationed in the country to work on construction projects, making for what may have been the largest international socialist aid effort in the history of communism. Still, all this assistance was smaller than the amount of aid the U.S. was pouring into South Korea, with much less impressive results. While the aid the DPRK received was crucial, much of the country's successful recovery can be attributed to the government's ability to organize and direct its population and limited resources toward the recovery effort. Mass mobilization campaigns put almost every available person to work, toiling long hours at clearing rubble and building new houses and other structures. The reconstruction effort demonstrated just what could be done by concentrating all available manpower to work at centrally directed projects. Unfortunately for North Koreans, no one was more impressed by this achievement than Kim Il-sung and his comrades. For the next six decades, they would follow this same pattern of marshaling the masses in an effort to achieve economic feats. In the early days, this produced some spectacular results. But after the 1960s, the campaigns became less and less effective. The showcase reconstruction project was the city of Pyongyang. Since American bombing raids had reduced it to rubble, Kim Il-sung had to construct a virtually new city. This he did with enthusiasm, personally supervising the project. It was a display city, designed to demonstrate the power of the state and the effectiveness of the revolution to everyone who lived or visited there. It had broad streets and wide plazas that were perfect for mass rallies and military parades, along with grandiose public buildings and ubiquitous monuments to the revolution and its leadership. Nothing remained of the old Pyongyang and its 2,000-year history. It was an entirely new, Stalinesque, modern urban space. Later, Kim added more and more monuments to himself and a subway system that functioned as a giant fallout shelter, buried so deep underground that it could withstand almost any air attack. Few cities in modern history were built to reflect the vision of a single person so comprehensively. Unfortunately, it was the vision of an aesthetically challenged, egocentric tyrant with a middle school education. Meanwhile, the economy was completely socialized. Elsewhere in the world, there were communist states that opted to allow some private businesses and private farming. But North Korea went for complete socialization, making only the most minimal of concessions to private ownership. Only Maoist China could match the degree to which free enterprise was eliminated. By the end of 1957, all farms had been merged into state-owned cooperatives. Peasants who had achieved their dream of owning their land a few years earlier now lost it. Everyone became a salaried laborer working for the state. Kim Il-sung then force-marched his country into the industrial age, beginning with his first five-year plan in 1957. This started off as a Soviet-inspired effort developing a modern industrial state. Then in 1958, Mao began his great leap forward, an attempt to overcome a shortage of skilled technicians and capital and achieve amazing leaps of development by mobilizing the entire population, instilling in them a revolutionary fervor, and then instructing them to build a great industrial socialist state. It is not clear how successful Mao was in inspiring his masses to heroic feats of reconstruction, but he did inspire Kim, who quickly altered his 5-year plan in imitation and radically revised his economic targets upward. When Mao announced that China would surpass Britain in steel production, Kim announced that he would surpass Japan in per capita industrial output in 10 years. When Mao consolidated the state farms into giant communes, Kim merged the 13,000 village-based cooperatives into 3,800 large-scale ones. Like Mao, he shifted much of the industrial production to local authorities. Kim never used the phrase "Great Leap Forward," but instead came up with the term "Chulima," a reference to a flying horse in Korean mythology that could leap 1,000 ri, one ri being approximately 400 meters, 1,312 feet, in a single bound. It symbolized what could be accomplished under the right direction. The inspiration for the Chulima movement, or so the story goes, came from an incident in which Kim visited a steel mill that was falling far short of its targets and stepped in to personally direct the work. When the management began listening to the needs and advice of the workers themselves and solving practical problems on the spot, the factory met its goals, then exceeded them, and then far exceeded them, finally becoming a virtual cornucopia of steel. Kim Il-sung became known for such miracles. In 1960, he spent a number of days on a cooperative farm listening to and instructing the farmers, and the output shot up. The following year, he worked his magic at a factory near Pyongyang. These became models of how officials could accelerate production by working directly with the farmers and factory hands, providing inspiration and guidance and listening to their suggestions. Kim himself would make endless on-the-spot guidance trips, thousands of them over the years, personally overseeing and inspiring the workers. His son and grandson would continue the tradition. Later economic plans were accompanied by speed battles to step up the pace of production. There were 70-day, 100-day, 200-day speed battles in which work was intensified, and people were expected to volunteer to labor well beyond the 40-hour legal work week. Workers were told to drink less soup so that they could take fewer bathroom breaks. Campaigns called for workers to see the morning stars, that is, to arrive at work early to put in extra labor. College students were often sent to farms and work sites to set up red flags and shout slogans to spur the workers on. Office workers were not spared, but also were asked to work on farms during planting or harvest times, or even on construction projects. The impressive results that Kim's use of mass mobilization campaigns for unrealistic targets, constantly subjecting the people to extra volunteer hours of labor, and motivating them by exhortations rather than material rewards, achieved in the early years only encouraged him to keep using the same tactic. And as mentioned, he continued with ever-diminishing results. A 7-year plan for 1961 to 67 made impressive progress, but fell short of its unrealistic targets and was extended by 3 years. Then a 6-year plan for 1971 to 76 came up still shorter. And so it went, with each new development plan missing its goals by a greater and greater margin, until by the 1980s the economy was hardly growing at all. Nonetheless, Kim stuck to the same old strategy of relying on mass labor and revolutionary zeal rather than searching for better methods and new approaches. Achieving political autonomy. No goal was more important to the North Korean leadership than achieving political autonomy. Kim Il-sung and his partisan comrades viewed their history as a story of how foreigners and their collaborators had subjugated the people and held the country back. It was their task to prevent this from happening again by making the country as strong and free from outside control as possible. Because of this fierce desire for independence, Kim Il-sung was wary of both Moscow and Beijing. Yet he needed aid and military support from the Soviets as well as the Chinese. The problem for him was how to get the support of the communist giants without being drawn into their orbit. A big opportunity came with the Sino-Soviet rift that came out in the open in 1961. Kim was able to triangulate, learning to establish good relations with both without being a satellite of either. It was a skill he learned the hard way by making costly miscalculations. First, he cleverly signed treaties of friendship with both communist neighbors, promising military support in the case of conflict. In fact, the treaties were signed in July 1961, just one day apart. But then he began to tilt toward China in the early 1960s and became openly critical of Moscow's bullying of other communist countries. The Soviets responded by reducing aid sharply, which was a blow to the North Korean economy. A chastened Kim Il-sung used the fall of Khrushchev in late 1964 as an excuse to improve relations, and the flow of aid resumed. Then relations with Beijing deteriorated during Mao's Cultural Revolution in the late 1960s, but the two sides made up in 1970, and for the next two decades, Kim was able to skillfully maintain positive relationships with both communist giants, distancing himself from their rivalry. While maintaining good relations with Moscow and Beijing was essential to maintaining his autonomy and fueling his economy, Kim Il-sung's main focus was on reunification. For a while, he put the issue on the back burner, concentrating on economic development, but not for long. In 1964, he spelled out his threefold plan for reunification. The first step was to build North Korea into an impregnable fortress. This meant creating a powerful military and literally fortifying the country so it could withstand an invasion or another bout of massive air attacks. It also meant indoctrinating the entire population so they would fiercely resist an invasion and unquestioningly obey orders from their leader. In the first decade after the Korean War, the regime's energies had been focused on economic development. Military buildup was important, but less of a priority. Now, needing to build up his armed forces, Kim adopted his equal emphasis policy, which would direct most of the country's scarce resources into creating a powerful military. In practice, this meant the nation could never sustain the same level of growth or fulfill the promises to materially improve the lives of its people. The second part of the plan was to foster the revolutionary forces in the South. Kim believed sending his army to liberate his countrymen below the parallel before they were ready for revolution had been the great mistake of 1950. Sooner or later, the South Korean people would rise up against the corrupt, incompetent South Korean regime, which was composed of Japanese collaborators and American stooges. Pyongyang's policy was to be a shining example of independence and progress, continuing to aid and abet progressive elements in the South who were living under the thumb of the U.S. imperialists until they were ready to rise up. The third part of the strategy for reunification was aimed at isolating the South Korean government and getting the Americans to withdraw from the peninsula by promoting and uniting revolutionary forces throughout the world. Put another way, Kim's strategy for reunification was to strengthen the North, weaken the South, and get the Americans out. Over the next 30 years of his extraordinarily long rule, Kim Il-sung and his comrades never deviated from this threefold strategy for reunification. It was the guiding principle behind North Korea's foreign policy. In the late 1960s, Pyongyang became a little impatient with the speed of the revolutionary forces in the South and decided to step up pressure on the regime. It may have hoped the American involvement in Vietnam would keep Washington preoccupied, or that the anti-government demonstrations in South Korea following the peace treaty with the Japanese might be indications of a latent revolutionary surge. In 1967, the North carried out numerous incidents along the DMZ, including exchanges of gunfire. In January 1968, it landed commandos along the eastern coast and attacked the Blue House, the ROK president's residence, in a failed attempt to kill Park Chung-hee, who had assumed the presidency of the ROK in 1963. Later that year, they landed 8 infiltration teams along coastal areas where they attempted to incite villagers to rebel, telling them they were being liberated and lecturing them on their need to rejoice and support the revolution. Instead of embracing their liberators, however, the locals quickly turned them in to the police. On the same day that the Northern Commandos attacked the presidential mansion, DPRK forces seized the U.S. naval intelligence ship Pueblo and held its 82 crew members captive for 11 months. The crew members wrote a hilariously absurd confession, filled with puns and insults that the North Koreans apparently didn't understand. As funny as this was, it was the DPRK that had the last word. They kept the ship, which is still anchored near the spot where the General Sherman was burned, and preserved it as a museum of U.S. imperialism. The provocations didn't end. The North Koreans shot down a U.S. spy plane the following year. However useful these actions might have been in testing the responses of the U.S. and the ROK to military provocations, Kim must have been disappointed with their failure to ignite the revolutionary forces in the South. He had the generals in charge of the attacks removed and then switched tactics. In 1972, the DPRK imitated Beijing's rapprochement with Washington by proposing peace talks with Seoul. Kim sent his brother to the South for negotiations. A few exchanges back and forth between Pyongyang and Seoul by representatives of both sides led to nothing, and the talks petered out the next year. Kim's demand that the U.S. withdraw before things could go further was a non-starter, rendering the talks useless. He then tried direct negotiations with Washington. Since the U.S. was disengaging from Vietnam, maybe it could be induced to sign a peace treaty with Pyongyang and leave the Korean Peninsula too. But the Americans simply ignored this transparent attempt to get them to abandon their South Korean allies. With a peace offensive getting him nowhere, Kim returned to provocations. In 1974, for example, a Japanese-Korean acting on DPRK orders attempted to assassinate Park Chung-hee while he was giving a televised speech. The shooter missed his target, but hit Park's wife. The iron-willed Park, after a pause, continued with his speech. In addition, several tunnels, big enough to drive armed vehicles through, were discovered under the DMZ. Furthermore, in 1976, North Koreans killed 2 Americans who were trimming a tree along the DMZ, causing a major incident and provoking a U.S. show of strength. In 1981 and 1983, Pyongyang made attempts to assassinate Chun Tu-hwan, Park Chung-hee's successor as ROK president. These continual provocations gave the Americans and other outsiders the impression of a dangerous, irrational regime, a perception that was only half right. The DPRK might have been dangerous, but it wasn't irrational. The acts of terrorism and military clashes served the regime's purposes. Kim and his successors used them to probe the South for its revolutionary potential and to test the Americans' resolve to defend Seoul, as well as to keep their forces and their people prepared for the day of liberation. Meanwhile, North Korea joined the Non-Aligned Movement in 1975 in an effort to both create international pressure on the U.S. to withdraw and to diplomatically isolate the regime in Seoul. At first, the North Koreans were successful at getting U.N. resolutions passed calling for the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the Korean Peninsula, and Pyongyang's cause gained support from many third-world countries. A stream of heads of state, especially from countries in Africa and other developing nations, paid visits to Pyongyang. No matter how small their country was, they would receive a massive, enthusiastic welcome by city residents who were dutifully obeying orders. But the clumsy manners of North Korea's inexperienced diplomats were counterproductive, and after a few years, the Non-Aligned Movement lost interest in supporting Pyongyang's cause. Up until 1980, reunification was still far off, but Kim Il-sung had not given up hope. Well, perhaps hope is not the correct word. He was fairly confident that eventually the tide of events would turn his way and he would be the leader of a united Korean nation. Creating a dynastic state. The Kim Dynasty and the rise of Kim Jong-il. No feature of North Korean society struck outsiders as being more bizarre than the cult of Kim Il-sung and his family. The cult originally began under the direction of the Soviets and was closely patterned after that of Stalin. In the 1960s, it was influenced by Mao Zedong's cult, which went beyond Stalin's. During the Cultural Revolution, millions of Chinese waved their little red books containing quotes by Mao. Praise for his leadership blared from public loudspeakers, and mass rallies took place with multitudes waving the mighty red banner of Mao Zedong thought. Yet Kim outdid Mao with a cult so extreme as to make even Mao blush. It was so central to all aspects of life that North Korea became a cult state. Kim Il-sung called the Cultural Revolution idiocy, but he was influenced by it, and in 1967 he began his own more modest version. There were no Red Guards smashing things up and harassing officials, but he did emulate Mao by intensifying his personal cult and creating his own thought. He began to be addressed as Churyong, leader, a term that had previously been reserved for Lenin and Stalin, and it became customary to preface it with Wideon, great, so that he was now almost always referred to as the great leader. He also became a great thinker. His thought was called Chuche. His various proclamations and speeches were gradually edited into an encyclopedia-length compendium of Chuche thought, also referred at times as Kim Il-sungism. Their content, which stressed self-reliance and a number of mind-numbingly repetitive statements on achieving revolutionary objectives, promoted what was perhaps the world's most tediously boring ideology. But it elevated Kim Il-sung from being not only a peerless patriot to a peerless thinker. In the 1970s and 80s, the state spent scarce foreign exchange funds and distributed free translated copies of Chuche thought abroad. Many can still be found, dusty and unread, in libraries across the world. And it set up Chuche study societies in a number of countries. In the new 1972 constitution, this time written by Koreans in Korean, Chuche was enshrined as the ideological foundation of the state. A few years after the Cultural Revolution was launched in 1966, the adulation of Mao Zedong's subjects toward their leader began to cool down a bit. This was not the case in North Korea, where the cult of Kim Il-sung continued to intensify into the 1970s and never diminished. Glorification of the great leader was raised to a new level on his 60th birthday on April 15, 1972, which was celebrated with extravagant fanfare. Thereafter, his birthday became the most important holiday in the Korean calendar. Then there were those badges with his picture on them. In the late 1960s, only officials wore them, but after 1972, everyone was expected to do so. The great leader's picture hung in virtually every room in every building. His statue appeared in almost every public square. There was no escaping his words and visage. Even the mountains in the remote wilderness were adorned with massive inscriptions quoting or praising him. His heroic leadership in the anti-Japanese struggle, or those of his comrades operating under his inspiration, became the main subject of plays, operas, songs, paintings, and movies. Kim's cult differed from those of Stalin, Mao, and other modern authoritarian rulers in that it extended to his family as well. In this way, it was very Confucian, very Korean. From the late 1940s, mention was made of the family line of patriot heroes that Kim was descended from. Over the years, North Koreans learned of his father, Kim Hyung-ji, who was credited with leading an anti-Japanese movement, and of his mother, Kim Pan-sok, another great patriot, although her Christian background was omitted. Then there was his great-grandfather, Kim Un-ku, who, in a fabricated account, led the attack on the General Sherman, now a key event in modern Korean history. By the late 1960s, the history of modern Korea was intertwined with the story of the Kim family, who were placed at the center of the struggle to create a modern, strong, independent nation. While the immense importance Koreans attached to family lineage explains some of this, there was another motive. Kim Il-sung worried about his succession. Although he was still a very healthy, vigorous man in his 50s, Kim Il-sung began to prepare for his succession in the 1960s. At first, he groomed his younger brother, Kim Young-chu, but there were some problems with this choice. Kim Young-chu never fought or played any role in the resistance or the party in its early years, and was also said to have health issues, although he ended up living well into his 90s. In any case, at some point, Kim Il-sung turned to his oldest son, Kim Jong-il, and made him his anointed successor. According to official biographers, Kim Jong-il was born on sacred Paktum Mountain on February 16, 1942, in the secret forest headquarters of a national anti-Japanese resistance, headed by his father. Amazingly, a rainbow appeared and flowers bloomed on the mountain, even though it was in the depth of the bitterly cold northern winter. In actual fact, he was born in 1941 in Siberia, where his father was working for the Soviets. Why even the year of his birth was changed is uncertain, but it follows a pattern of official histories changing details of the past for reasons that are often obscure. He attended a special school for the children of high-ranking officials, then enrolled in Kim Il-sung University, where the elite studied. While still in his 20s, he was appointed to some important party posts as a junior member. Being artistically inclined, he moved to the wonderfully named Propaganda and Agitation Department of the Korean Workers' Party, where he directed his attention to producing plays, operas, and movies glorifying his father. He even wrote a treatise on film, which became mandatory reading for anyone in the cinematic world of the DPRK. His emergence as successor was carried out in a rather careful way. Sometime around 1974, he was designated as the successor by his father, but this was only known to party insiders. Not until the 6th Party Congress in 1980 did Kim Jong-il appear in public under that designation for the first time. Even afterward, he never spoke publicly, but pictures of him standing alongside his father became ubiquitous, and his pronouncements on various topics were given the same weight. His name, when it appeared in print, was set in the same special large type previously reserved for his father. His birthday, February 16th, became a holiday, and the period between that date and April 15th, his father's birthday, became the loyalty season. Kim Jong-il became the dear leader. He was also referred to as great leader, but with the word chido-cha, used to mean leader, which sounded a bit less exalted than Chu-ryong, the term used for his father. With Kim Jong-il as the heir apparent, North Korea became a dynastic state. Kim Il-sung's cult expanded to include almost all members of his family, including his first wife, as well as his second, Kim Jong-il's mother, Kim Chun-suk, who was called the Mother of Korea. In reality, the DPRK had become a monarchy, and the great leader's lineage, the royal family. Everybody has a Songbun, the new hierarchy. North Korea's leadership, being good communists, called for the end of economic and social inequality. Yet what they created was a rigidly hierarchical society. In fact, in many ways, it was a mirror image of the old Korea, with social ranks simply reversed, workers and peasants on the top, and yongpan at the bottom. As in the old Korea, in this new socialist one, status was based on bloodlines. In early times, there were the bone ranks, and later the sharp differences between yongpan, commoners, and low or mean people. These were replaced by new hierarchies in the DPRK. In the 1950s, the regime undertook a careful background check of the entire population, placing each person into one of three categories, kaechung. At the top, there was the core class, consisting of those with politically reliable and socially desirable backgrounds, landless peasants, industrial workers, and those who had fought in the anti-Japanese resistance. Next came the wavering class, a somewhat less reliable group. At the bottom was the hostile class, who had undesirable backgrounds, landowners, businessmen, those who had served in the colonial government, Christians, those who had been Buddhist priests or shamans. It also included those with relatives in the south and southerners who had been captured or kidnapped and brought north during the Korean War. The three groupings were based on the degree to which their loyalty to the communist regime could be counted on. The core class were called tomatoes, red all the way through. The wavering class were apples, red only on the outside, and the hostile class were grapes, not red at all. Each class was hereditary, based on one's parents or grandparents, and was in turn passed along to one's children. About 30% of the population were in the core class, 50% comprised the wavering class, and 20% were in the hostile class. In the late 1950s, many members of the hostile class were relocated to more remote areas, such as the Northeast. They were generally forbidden to reside in the capital, Pyongyang, the most desirable place to live, or near the border with South Korea. This class system, though it might better be described as a caste system, was further refined in the 1960s. The three classes were subdivided into 51 subgroups called songpun, graded by reliability. 12 songpun made up the core class. Those with worker backgrounds, former farmhands and landless peasants, KWP members, etc. Near the top were relatives of deceased revolutionaries, national liberation fighters, or war heroes. 9 songpun made up the wavering class, and 30 made up the hostile class. The latter included all manner of bad backgrounds. Those who had engaged in pro-Japanese or pro-American activities, or who had family members who were charged with political crimes, or who were originally from the South, and so forth. A few more categories were added later. Songpun were never publicly mentioned. They were listed in secret government files, but everyone pretty much knew where they belonged. One songpun determined one's life chances. It would designate things like eligibility for desirable jobs and entry into good schools. Children from bad songpun became aware of the fact at around the age 12, when they were barred from donning the red scarf of the Kim Il-sung youth with the other kids. They were unlikely to be admitted to a university or ever live in Pyongyang. It was possible, but difficult, to rise in status, and easier to fall to a lower rung if one got into political trouble of some sort. Life was certainly hard for those in a bad songpun, but it was hard for most people. The real gap was between the upper levels of the core class, who formed the true elite of high-ranking party members and their families, and everyone else. The elite lived in special neighborhoods, went to special schools, and enjoyed a life of privilege and relative comfort. Making up about 1% of the population, they had access to imported luxury goods and could automatically expect their children to go to top schools, Kim Il-sung University being at the apex of the system. They had their own special hospitals with up-to-date medical care. A few had foreign luxury cars and drank imported cognac. This small elite of party officials, high-ranking military officers, and the upper echelon of the bureaucracy were still subordinate to the innermost elite, those related to or with some close personal connection to Kim Il-sung and his family. North Korea also retained its traditional pattern of male dominance, even though the regime claimed to practice gender equality. Women did have access to equal education, could share inheritances, and could divorce. Theoretically, all occupations were open to them. Indeed, this was a major change in Korean society. Part of this push for gender equality was to deal with the labor shortage, since economic development was dependent on mobilizing manpower and so many young men were in the military. Women made up the majority of the labor force in light industries. Free daycare centers were available, and working women were given additional rations. However, they did not have to work, and some stayed home to take care of children and do the housework. All this rhetoric and legal framework for gender equality was a facade, disguising the reality that it was a man's world. Women seldom held high-status jobs. Many were school teachers, but few were professors. Few women rose to any positions of authority in government, in the party, or in management. The only women who ever attained anything approaching a leadership post were the relatives of the Kim family, and none of them held a top spot. Women were still expected to cook for their husbands. In fact, working women were allowed to go home early so they could get supper ready. The role of women as mothers was also given great importance in official indoctrination. Of course, their primary duty was to raise revolutionary children dedicated to the regime, with unquestioning loyalty to the great leader. Most women wore simple clothes in traditional style. When Kim Il-sung got tired of looking at the drab dress of his female compatriots, he ordered women to wear more colorful blouses. And they complied, often donning Western skirts and blouses. But then he warned them not to go too far and reveal too much. Men, incidentally, almost always wore simple Western clothes, with a suit and tie for special occasions. As in the old Korea, everyone was expected to marry. Marriage ceremonies tended to be simple and included bowing before a portrait of the great leader and pledging loyalty to him as well as to one another, and starting in the 1980s to Kim Jong-il as well. Those who married were not kids. The minimum marriage age was 28 for women and 30 for men, the highest legal age in the world. This was to limit population growth, which was quite high after the war. When, after a generation, the birth rate started dropping, coming close to replacement level by the late 1980s, the marriage age restrictions were relaxed. But it was still difficult for most men, at least, to marry young, since they spent so many years in military service. Divorce had been made easy in 1946 with the law of equality between the sexes, but then in the mid-1950s it became more difficult again. The 1972 Constitution declared that families are the cell of society. All families, so the propaganda organs proclaimed, had to be bound by unfailing devotion to the great leader as well as to each other. Loyalty between parent and child and the love of one's parents were praised, and family-related terms were used in propaganda. Even the great leader was the Appoyi Churyong, or fatherly leader, or, more correctly, the parently leader, since the Korean term Appoyi can mean either fatherly or motherly. Of course, there were some political reasons for this emphasis on family, aside from the momentum of tradition. As Kim Il-sung converted his rule into a dynasty, emphasizing the importance of family and bloodlines was a way to promote acceptance of this idea, and it made the nepotism that characterized all the members of the elite, as they placed family members in key positions, seem more natural. No need for money. The command economy. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea was about as far from a market economy as any modern society has been. People lived in state-owned houses. Most city dwellers resided in small apartments in grim buildings. They had indoor plumbing, although it was common for several families to share a bathroom. They had electricity, although it was not always on. Few had elevators, so apartments on the lower floors were more desirable. Rents were nominal, meaning housing was essentially free. A public distribution system rationed food and other basic goods. Each family received coupons for a certain quantity of rice, cooking oil, clothes, etc., which they exchanged at a distribution center. On the birthday of the great leader or some other special event, they might receive some Korean liquor for the adults, candy for the children, and meat for everyone. These were gifts from the leader to the people he so loved. There were no private markets. Salaries were very small, but it didn't matter much since there was little to buy. Most people got by with the basic necessities. There was little money to spend and few places to spend it, and little time to shop anyway. Most people worked long hours, for in addition to the 8-hour day, 40-hour week mandated by law, they were required to arrive early and stay after for political meetings, discussions of the day's tasks, instructions from the authorities, and discussion of the daily news. On weekends, there were voluntary work days. Then there were constant campaigns for additional volunteer hours or participation in mass rallies. Nor was there any place to go in one's free time. No churches, temples, private clubs, or organizations were permitted. All leisure time was spent at home with family or taken up in state-managed organizations. Universal education through middle school was achieved by the 1970s, but for secondary students, much of the school time was spent volunteering on public projects, from road construction to harvesting crops. basic health care was available, and an immunization program reduced the death rates so that by the 1980s, North Koreans had life expectancies closer to those in the First World than those in other poor states. All basic needs were largely met, even if at a very no-frills level. Entertainment and art were forms of indoctrination. Literary works were always about the heroic deeds of those who had fought for the revolution and their devotion to the leadership, or about the atrocities committed by foreigners, usually Japanese or Americans. Stories began with quotes from the great leader, and later his son. Art, music, cinema, and theater followed the same types of storylines. Newspapers contained little that would pass for actual news. Mention of foreign events was limited to items such as the meeting of the Chuche Study Club of Khartoum met today to study the works of the great leader Kim Il-sung. Or there were reports of their fellow Koreans in the South who led miserable lives under the heel of the South Korean military clique and their American imperialist puppet masters waiting to be reunited under the great leader Kim Il-sung. Occasionally, the regime carried out campaigns to donate food or clothing for their suffering southern compatriots. Life in the cities, as grim as it might appear to outsiders, was probably better than on the farm. Farmers worked under detailed instructions from the center. They were permitted only tiny private plots, big enough to grow chili peppers and some other vegetables, and like everyone else, were allotted specific quantities of food, clothing, and other necessities. Farms were self-sufficient, with their own schools, distribution centers, and medical centers. As a result, there was no need to leave the farm. In fact, it was forbidden to do so without permission, making farmers virtual prisoners on the land they worked. Knowing every chopstick and spoon, the surveillance society. North Koreans were told, and children's songs proclaimed, that they were living in a paradise on earth where we have nothing to envy in the world. Yet this was a strange paradise. In fact, by the 1970s, when Kim Il-sung's political system was fully functioning, the DPRK had become as close to George Orwell's 1984 as any society ever had. Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union are characterized as totalitarian societies, but the term is even more apt for Kim's state. Koreans in the North were told where to work and where to live, and were under almost constant surveillance. Each neighborhood or apartment building formed an Inmin-pan, headed by an Inmin-pan-chang, usually a middle-aged woman whose job was to know everything about everyone, every chopstick and spoon, as the saying went. Visitors to a home were noted, and permission was required for them to stay overnight. Homes were subject to unannounced inspection by special security units, the midnight home check, and by the Inmin-pan-chang. No foreign literature of any kind was permitted, not even from other communist countries. Radios and televisions were fixed so that they could only be tuned to state channels and were checked during security inspections to see they had not been tampered with. Special travel permits were required to buy a train or bus ticket or to go to another city or town. For residents outside the capital, permission to visit Pyongyang was difficult. When granted, it was considered the chance of a lifetime to see this wondrous place with its famous monuments. The Safety Bureau kept track of all citizens and all party and state officials. Everyone was subjected to constant indoctrination. All workers had to attend regular self-criticism sessions at their factory, office, or farm. At these, they had to take turns confessing to not living up to the expectations of the revolution and its great leader, promising to study his works and follow his instructions with greater diligence. Each citizen had to memorize and adhere to a set of guidelines, the 10 principles for the establishment of the monolithic ideological system. The first stated, "We must devote ourselves completely to the struggle to unify the entire society with the revolutionary ideology of great leader Kim Il-sung." The rest were pledges of absolute loyalty and obedience to the great leader, to follow his instructions unhesitatingly, to learn from him, etc. Failing to adhere to these guidelines was punishable by imprisonment. For those who fell afoul of the authorities, there was a hierarchy of prison camps. Some were only temporary detention centers for minor infractions. Others were grim, long-term labor camps. The worst were the ones political prisoners were sent to, the Kwaliso, North Korea's archipelago of labor camps, its version of Stalin's gulag, but worse, and also a bit stranger. Most were located in remote mountain valleys and resembled a string of villages rather than a conventional prison camp. The biggest covered a large area, a whole valley in some cases. They were sometimes divided into revolutionizing zones and total control zones. The first involved not only hard labor, but many hours of memorizing the works of the great and dear leaders. Although the conditions in revolutionizing zones were appalling, there was hope for rehabilitation and release. For the less fortunate, the total control zones were truly hell. Like Dante's Inferno, whose gate had a sign that stated, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," there was no hope for inmates. They were simply worked to death. The strangest aspect of the Kwaliso was the practice of imprisoning entire families. This often encompassed three generations. A convicted political prisoner could be joined by his children and his parents, or his parents and grandparents. This odd practice was a revival of the traditional Korean practice of collective responsibility, in which parents were responsible for the crimes of their children, elder brothers for the crimes of their younger siblings. Family members were encouraged to inform on one another, and whatever solace there was in having loved ones nearby was offset by the horror of seeing them tortured, starved, and worked to death. This was also a consideration for those who defected, as doing so could result in their loved ones being sent off to a Kwaliso. Spouses, not being blood relatives, could sometimes avoid being imprisoned, but it required both denouncing their marital partner and getting a divorce. Over time, the prisons were consolidated into a smaller number, each with as many as 50,000 inmates. The Socialist Paradise. The handful of foreign visitors who made their way to North Korea in the 70s and 80s were often impressed by the order, the cleanliness, the lack of extreme poverty, and the progress the country had made in industrialization and education. Yet even the more sympathetic guests could be uncomfortable with the extreme cult of Kim Il-sung and his family, and the isolation of the people who had little contact with or knowledge about the outside world. What did most North Koreans really think of their society? It's hard to know, but most seemed to accept that they were very lucky to be living in this socialist paradise and to have such a wise and compassionate leader.